Could we give a massive whoop and a cheer? It was the last time we saw Tristan's incredible trailer. He had to spend 500 hours just on getting inappropriate things from the internet. Google now thinks he's a pervert, but he did it for us. It's for a good cause. Listen, we've been doing this series, Crazy Sexy Love. The idea is that the Bible has an ethic for sex. And we've talked about that. We've expanded on that in the first episode. And it's very easy to look at it, particularly if you're on the outside looking in and if you're not a believer here or not a church person here. It's easy to look at that and think, that's crazy. How can anyone keep sex for marriage? That's just ridiculous. It doesn't work. It's outdated. It's puritanical. It's old-fashioned. It's unfit for purpose. It's crazy. But the more you look at it, the more sane it seems. And the more it seems to make sense. The fact of the matter is that every single one of us here, we have an ethic for sex. You might not subscribe to the Christian ethic. You may have your own views. You may have your own practice. But everyone has an ethic for sex, whether that is I won't sleep with anyone on the first date, or I will only sleep with them on the first date, or whether it's only sex within marriage, or I won't get together with anyone that I work with, or I won't sleep with someone's boyfriend, or whatever it may be. Everyone has some kind of ethic, you know, a series of values and practice around sex. But actually, the Christian, the kind of the key to the Christian understanding and take on sex and the sex ethic for Christians is that it has this kind of elevated view of sex, that rather than sex being something disconnected from everything else, that it's just a fun physical activity, the Bible actually says that it is fundamental to the core of who we are as individuals, and it keys into something that's so profound about us and about the way that we relate and the way that we do relationships over life. And so last time I was here, we talked about that love triangle, that researchers have found there's three distinct areas within the brain that work towards this kind of sense of being in love and loving someone. You've got romantic desire, which is like this powerful urge. You've got sexual intimacy. And then you've got this kind of emotional attachment where you can be long-term bonded with someone. But sex is kind of integral. It's in the heart of that. And actually, it brings online your attachment systems in your physiology, your neurobiology, and just the way that you feel and experience relationships and the world. And so the Bible says, you know, let's put this within a context where it can work for us and help us to build something really, really powerful. But the question this evening is, how do you keep all of that stuff going for life? How do you keep it over the long haul? You know, all of us want to be happy. We want to be together with someone and make it work. We have dreams and ideals, and sometimes people will say, that's not reasonable, it's not realistic. But at the heart of us, we want something. We want something that will sweep us away. We want something that will keep us safe and secure. We want to feel loved. We want to feel known by someone else. We want to be able to share our life. We want someone that's going to be there through thick and thin, no matter what. But is it realistic? Is it practical? Can you sustain it? How does that even work? In preparing for this the other day, just last week, I spoke to my wife, Kate. We've been married for 27 years. I know, got married when I was 10. That's my line. I use it every time. It's now a reflex. But I said to her, I said, "Hun," I said, "do you still find me attractive?" And she said, "Would you like the brutal, honest truth?" Which is an awful thing for your spouse to say to you. I said, "Okay, go for it. Give me your best shot. I can take it." She said, "Well, frankly, your looks peaked 10 years ago. But you've still got a good body. So I'm going to take that." And then I was feeling a little bit bruised because she kind of went on, she expanded. I'm not going to tell you all the things that she wrote. It was, you know, this is sagging and that is drooping and that one's got too big. And it was the brutal, honest truth. But I said, "But do you love me like you did 10 years ago when I was this apparent Adonis and physical specimen?" She says, "I love you more." And I can talk about a relationship which has had highs and it's had lows. I can talk about how we have, on more than one occasion, been on the brink of disaster, breakup, divorce, and heartache. But I know that it is possible to sustain love over the long term and actually to enjoy it while you're going at it. And I actually believe that the relationships that the Bible puts out are applicable for us no matter where we are at. Now, in a talk like this, everyone's in a different position. Everyone's in a different state. You've all got your own background, your own situation. Everyone is individually unique. But I do believe that no matter where you are, whether you're young or old, whether you're rich or you're poor, whether you're gay or whether you're straight, I think these principles for relationship, actually they hold water. So I invite you just to take a look at them. Because not only does the Bible give us a sexual ethic to live by and follow and say, this is the way, but it constantly explains and unpacks why this makes sense. Crazy on first inspection, more sane the further you dig underneath the surface. This whole question about can you sustain life, can you sustain relationship over a lifetime? People have been asking this same question for thousands of years. It's not a modern thing just because we live a little bit longer than the ancients. They've been asking these same questions for so long. This one group of people, they came to Jesus with this very question. It says this, it says, some Pharisees came to him to test him. They asked, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any and every reason? In other words, they're saying, look, I know we men, we've married these women, but you know, it would be great if we could just divorce them as easily as we like. Because how can you sustain it? And what happens if you go off them or you don't like them anymore or they stop pleasing you? How can a man get out of this kind of thing? And again, you have to hear the dripping patriarchy, misogyny that's coming out of this question. And also the fact that the Bible notes as he's writing this, Matthew sees that there's an element where they're trying to test him. Because even then, when even Jesus himself talks about relationship, it's contentious. It can cause a stir. And they're trying to get him to say something that's going to offend everybody and just get them to stop following him or listening to him. They wanted him to be dismissed. And Jesus is brilliant because he starts with them on their own territory, their own turf. The Pharisees are the people that love to study the scriptures. And he says to them this, he says, haven't you read, he replied, that at the beginning, the creator made them male and female. It's a huge amount of shade that he's throwing on them. He's saying, you Pharisees, haven't you read the Bible? Haven't you read like on page one at the very beginning? It says, and then he goes on to talk about God's initial idealized principles for human thriving and flourishing. But he just pulls them short with these three words. He says, the creator made them male and female. You're asking as this kind of entitled, patriarchy, misogynistic man, how can I get rid of my wife? And yet the radical message of the Christianity that we hold to says right from page one, and Lex brought this home so beautifully last week, God created male and female equal in his own image. You shouldn't treat women as if they are less. You shouldn't treat them as if they are beneath you. You shouldn't treat them as if they're something to be discarded, to be done with when you've had enough of them. They are equally created in the image of God. And there's nothing like this in ancient thought or literature. Nothing. No other way of thinking about the world has said from ancient times, male, female, equally created in God's image. In fact, in those days, they didn't even have human beings created in the divine image. It was only the Caesar, the Pharaoh, the despot. But here, God says, I'm giving equal value and dignity. Therefore, he says, therefore, for this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. So they're no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no one separate. He's saying, guys, seriously, you shouldn't be thinking about how you can leave your wife. You should be reminding yourselves that God's plan for you was to leave everything for your wife. These two ideas, you leave, the man gets to leave. You know, in the Jewish mentality that Jesus is pushing here, it's not the woman that's given away, it's the man that voluntarily leaves. If anyone's being given away, it's the man. And there's an idea of leave, and in the old-fashioned translation, cleave. Leave and be united, or leave and cleave. Leave and join together with the wife. And this whole thing is what we call, it's the highest form of commitment. It's covenant. A covenant is a kind of commitment between two people that says, I am giving up everything. I'm leaving everything. He says, the man and the woman, these two people coming together, you both leave everything in your past. You leave every support structure. You burn every single bridge. You throw yourself all in. All of you for all of them. All of you for all of them, no matter what. Because of this, you're going to leave where you've come from. You're going to be united. You're going to create a new thing. And then you're going to be one flesh. And it's more than just the sexual union. It is about a spiritual union, a coming together. My hopes, my dreams, my ambitions, my desires, all of my life, the journey that I'm going on, it's with you. It's a brand new humanity, a new flesh. And so Jesus, in one foul swoop, he raises the dignity of women and men equal to one another. And then he raises the dignity of sex, that it's something which is God-inspired and God-ordained, and that God is joining you together in a wonderful way, that God's made you for this kind of intimate union together. But he's also elevating this form of commitment, this covenant where you literally give up everything for the other person, that you make a total leap of faith with that other person to establish something brand new, a one flesh relationship that should not be separated. Now again, Jesus is talking ideal. He's talking in the beginning. He's talking God's gracious purposes. And actually the question that he has about divorce, he then goes on to say, look, we don't live in a perfect world. Sometimes a marriage just cannot stay together. Sometimes a relationship can be toxic. Sometimes things can happen. But this is an ideal, and these are principles. And what I want to unpack just for us in this moment is principles, because I think the principles hold. I think they hold for you if you're thinking about marriage, if you're already married, if you're living together, if you're single, if you would like to be with someone, or if you're happy on your own. I think these are principles for how we do life well and how we do relationship in a really flourishing, thriving way. But what Jesus says to the question of how on earth do you keep together, he answers it with this key concept. Commitment. Commitment. Leave, cleave. Leave, be united. All of me for all of you, no matter what. Commitment is the key. And so when we ask the question, how can love possibly sustain commitment for a lifetime? It's a question that many people have. You know, they will say, well, something like marriage, it works when people lived shorter lives or where they had lower expectations. But how can you possibly love someone and commit yourself to them for a lifetime? How can that even be real? People change. People, they go through different things and they grow apart sometimes. How can love sustain a commitment for a lifetime? And Jesus says, and this is brilliant, he says, swip that around, just flip it around. It's commitment that sustains love for a lifetime. And that's the brilliance, the genius of what Jesus says. And all he's doing is he's quoting literally at the beginning, the very beginning, this line that keeps coming up, the kind of the nugget, the gold standard of the Christian view of sex and relationship. He says, actually, commitment will keep your love and it will sustain your love. Commitment will keep you close to one another. Commitment will keep that flame of desire and connection alive for a lifetime. What God has joined together, let no one separate. And it is possible to be together, to be without separation, and to enjoy it. Now, I just want to unpack a little bit about commitment, because I don't want you to think that commitment just means, well, you sign the piece of paper and then you're stuck and then you got to go for it. Actually, I want to look at some of the work that researchers do when they look at relationships and how relationships work, particularly with the whole idea of commitment theory. Now, with commitment, there's two kinds of commitment. It comes in two different forms. You've got internal commitment, and then you've got external commitment. Now, internal commitment is my choices. It comes from the inside of me. I choose to love you. I want to be with you. I enjoy what I'm getting into. I really want this. I desperately long and yearn and move towards it out of my own free will, my own volition. But external is I'm committed to something because of the circumstance that I am in, because of the externals around me, because of things that are outside of my direct control, but they nonetheless keep me committed into this thing. Easiest way to think about this is think about your job. Now, put your hands up if you have a job that you love so much that the money is secondary for you. Put your hands up. Let's see. Okay. Hey, Alexia. A round of applause for Alexia. She's sitting on the front row. She works for the church. She knew, I've got to put my hand up. Put your hands back up. Let me see who's the money is secondary. So we've got midwife. Shout out your job. Sports, yeah, over here.
Investment.
Yes, okay. Yes.
TA.
That's my own wife. All I saw was this disembodied hand. It was like, I know what you do. Education, darling. Okay, put your hand up if you are in a job and you're in it because it pays you. You feel like, you know, you let them down. If you left, it would be difficult for you to replace that job. It's maybe not the ideal job, but it will do for now. Put your hands up. Okay. Someone's like, put your hand down. It's really, really interesting because you can be in a job and you can be committed to it. You literally show up day in, day out. You work. You expend energy. You're there when they want you to be there. You stay till they want you to stay. And we have this mixture of external things. So an external thing is they pay me. I need the money. If I gave up this job, I wouldn't be able to afford my rent. In this present climate, it's no big thing. It's no easy thing to find something to replace it. Or you may feel, I feel a sense of loyalty to my boss or to my team. And, you know, Jenny from accounts has just taken maternity leave and it's put everyone under pressure. And I kind of, it's not a good time to go, even if I did want to go. And we can have all these external things. But here's the thing. Both sides of commitment are useful and helpful, but it's the internal stuff that makes me enjoy it more. And I would be really interested to go back to all those people, and maybe you can talk about this afterwards or talk about it in hubs. Those that say, I do the job. I spoke to someone before the service. I said, look, if someone would pay you twice as much to work in a bank, would you do it? No. Education, again. Because it's like, I want to do this. I love doing it. It's more than the money. And when your desire and when the internal driver is at least the same or greater than the external things keeping you in there, you tend to enjoy it more. Now, we tend to call these things, or I call them in my stuff, the internal one is your decision. I've made a decision. It's my will. It's my free choice. I am in this of my own choice. But the external is constraints. And just like that works within, say, your job or whether you're a student. You know, hopefully if you're a student, you chose what you're doing. You chose this subject. You're internally self-motivated. But we can apply the same thing to relationships. I just want to just expand it a little bit because I want you to imagine your relationship is like a sleek jet engine. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the love jet. You could be flying high in the love jet. Can you get the love jet off the ground, off the runway, into the clouds, take you far, take you high? I don't know. I feel like Barry White is singing in my head right now. But the love jet. But I seriously want you to imagine that you've got two engines. The first engine is that decision engine. It's the internal things that keep you in a relationship. It's my will, my choices. It's I want this. It's my desire. You know, we talked a couple of weeks ago about romantic desire being an urge, a drive that pushes you. I want this. I am desperate. I would die for you. When I first met Kate, I wrote songs. Such songs, ladies and gentlemen, that would cause the stoniest heart to crack in two. Because I was motivated. I wanted to be in it. Desire, your decision. But the other engine is constraints. It's the constraints engine. And actually, like I said, the more that you've got these two engines powered up, the better that it will be. You see, the more that I can have commitment in a relationship, the better chance I have of enjoying that relationship and that relationship standing the test of time. Now, you could take a marriage, you could take any kind of relationship, romantic relationship. What would you say, someone throw it out, what would you say would be an external constraint keeping two people together who are in a relationship? Pet dog, yeah, that's very good. Statistically, researchers say that people, a couple, are more likely to stay together if they have a shared pet than if they have a shared child. Weird, but true. Okay, what did you say over here? Child, yeah, child, very good. What are the things, physical things about your house, rent, mortgage? So living situation. You can be living with someone, you could be married to them, but actually if you are now in a rental position, situation with them, and you've moved all your stuff out of your place, and who can afford to have two places going at the same time? You've kind of crossed that line, you've defined the relationship, you're now moving in together, you live together. Actually, that is a constraint that keeps you in a relationship, because now it's just part of your whole life. You live there. It would be an enormous faff to even change that. What are the things in marriage or civil partnership?
Disability.
Disability? Yeah, you could have something where you're reliant on the other person. What are the things?
Same friendship circle,
very good. Let me put one on before that. I'd say finance. You may share your bills together. You may be legally bound, whether that is a civil partnership or whether that is a marriage contract. Or it may just be that you've taken on, I don't know, some kind of hire purchase lease scheme together. You're now financially keyed in, or you're going on holiday together. You've got that shared thing. Then the friendship, so that's social pressure. The moment that you're going out within a bunch of friends, and there's a bunch of friends that know you, that puts on pressure actually to keep the relationship in, to keep you going. When your families meet up, your families get involved, and then your mum likes them more than they like you. Not that I am sad about that, but it's true. You've got this pressure. Oh, no, don't. You're not doing well. You guys, give it your best shot. You've got pressure from the outside, from family. Some of you have already said children being another one. And here's another one that we obviously talked about from weeks one and two, and that would be sex. Actually, sex, arguably, is something that actually puts a kind of connectivity between you. When you're sleeping with someone, it is, like I said, and if you miss this, go back a couple of weeks. But it brings online your attachment systems in the very core of your kind of thinking and your neurochemistry and the chemicals that are released, the oxytocin, the vasopressin, the things that naturally make us close to one another, to want to trust them. That can be outside of feelings. The moment that I start sleeping with someone, we're going to form a connection. We're going to form a bond. And that actually will keep me, like an external thing, committed or core into this relationship. Just a couple of things to mention. Children, keep it on the same page, please. Back one. That's it. Now I've got to go through the whole list again. Children, very good. Children can be a massive thing in keeping people together, and it can be a massive thing in tearing people apart. I said that Kate and I, we've been happily married for 27 years. I'm not sure that's completely, totally true. If you ask Kate how many years we've been happily married, she'll give you a totally lower figure. Because we have had times when it has been really, really challenging and tough. And I'll tell you, the moment that I got to that, well, it probably wasn't that close, but I felt like I wanted to leave this woman.
was the classic time. And this happens again, 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 and again. It was first year, first child. For us, it was year three. But in that year, I found for the very first time that my constraints engine was bigger than my decision engine. And before it was like, I love you. I want to be with you. I'm the luckiest man in the world. And now it's like, I am trapped to this hag. And I have had enough. And I am getting the short end of the stick. And I am, probably a lot of it was just, we were just both crazy. It was a hard time. And Zoe, if you're listening to this on Spotify, shout out to my daughter in Dubai. It's all good now. But at the time, you nearly wrecked the marriage. I wanted out so badly. And what made me miserable was my constraints engine was way higher than my desire engine. Actually, on our 10th wedding anniversary, Kate took us both away. We went on a luxury holiday, nice, beautiful hotel overseas. And then she nearly walked out on me. She said, I'm fed up. I've had enough. And actually, for her, it was her constraints engine was much higher than her decision engine. And she just thought, I don't want this anymore. I'm not getting what I need. And it was, I can remember a time when I just thought, I'm not sure how we're going to get through this. Plus, it's our holiday and we've paid money for this hotel. Why now? In fact, Kate just this morning said, I booked us a hotel, a little mini break in Amsterdam next month. I'm thinking, what have I done? But these things, the key is always, I want my decision, I want my choice, I want my will to be at the same level as the constraints that I'm under. But I don't want to lose the constraints because the constraints are good. The bad news is, if I'm in a bad relationship, constraints will keep me in longer than I really should be in that relationship. If I'm in a good relationship, the constraints will keep us together through the challenging, hard time. In the nappy-filled, noxious, fume, sleep-deprived hellscape, there is parenthood. I'm sorry, but it's a lovely, wonderful joy, and our children have brought us such love. But it's commitment externally that will sometimes hold us in. Here's another time that relationships will often break up. It's about the 21-year mark. So it's not the 7-year itch, it's a 21-year itch. Who has an idea why that might be? Kids leave home, or they're old enough to take care of themselves, and they'll probably be okay if it doesn't go very well. But that's a classic thing. And what happens is that when the kids leave, you know, you go into emptiness, or you go where they don't really need you in the same way anymore. Suddenly you realize, oh my goodness, I just lost a massive constraint. Engine number two has lost a huge number of power, and now we're in turbulence, and we're losing altitude because I didn't have the same desire. And we realized that we hadn't invested in the desire part of the relationship. We just got lazy and let the constraints keep us in. Because they will keep you in. You will stay together. There's all these different things that keep us together. But when they go, we can find ourselves in trouble. We can find ourselves in difficulty. Now, I want to talk a little bit about cohabitation and living together. I want to do this sensitively because this is the, by far, preferred way for most people to prepare for marriage. The idea with cohabitation is we're getting into this love jet together and we're going to take off on the runway. But what happens is that it actually, cohabitation, and again, I have married people who've lived together and I've seen their relationships and I've seen them do well. I know that it can work out for them. So I'm not knocking it per se, but I'm just wanting to highlight to you the fundamental issue that you experience with living with someone before taking things further. Seeing living together as a kind of stage of the relationship going deeper. And that is this. You are literally starting your plane with a deliberately underpowered decision engine. That decision, instead of I do till death us do part, is actually I think so, I may, I might, let's wait and see. Instead of leave and cleave, It's wait and see or try before we buy. Let's try it out. And it comes obviously from the best place possible. I don't know anybody who's moved in with someone and didn't do it because they loved that person, because they were doing it because they wanted to take the relationship to the next level and to really make sure that they could really love one another over the long haul. But it's like trying to take a plane off the runway without full power. And what the funny thing about constraints and decision, it's not literally just my own pet theory. This is something that people that work in relationship and commitment theory look at and try to tease out. They have ways of measuring the level and the strength of your desire, your internal commitment to relationship. And what people find time and time again is that when you move in with someone, your constraints go up or down. Up, massively up. Because now you are living together, now you have got financial stuff together, social pressure goes up. Suddenly it's an enormous faff to get out of this relationship if it's not right. But what happens is it tends to stunt the growth of your decision making. And sometimes people, and I've heard people say this to me with all the best will in the world, they say, Philip, we want to move in together because we want to make it easier for the relationship to grow and to develop. You know, it's really difficult living apart and having to jump through all the hoops. It's really hard to really build and sustain this relationship. If we lived together, life would be so much easier. And I always want to say, and I usually do, that's exactly the wrong thing. You should want to embrace the difficulty because it's the difficulty that grows that engine. It allows that decision engine to power up. And if you just allow constraints before the relationship is fully formed to take the weight to carry the plane, then you find that you end up like the person with the job that they're just kind of in it because it pays the bills, not necessarily enjoying it as much as the person that is doing the very thing that they absolutely love. And so cohabitation, moving in together, what it does is it puts constraints way up, but the decision thing has not been fully powered. Here's some of the findings on cohabitation, that couples that cohabit are much more likely to break up than marriage. At which point you say, well, duh, that's the whole point. You're testing it out. You're giving it a run for its money. Better to break up when you're just living together than to end up being divorced and having all that kind of psychic fallout. But actually what it does is relationships that could have lasted, that could have survived, actually they fall because the cohabiting, the moving in together actually breaks them. Next one, it says 1 in 5 cohabiting relationships leads to marriage. Sometimes you go in and you really want to lead to marriage and say, let's live together first and let's see how this is going to pan out. But actually what you're doing is you're actually potentially, and everyone is different and this is not necessarily you, you're all individual and these are just generalities. I'm talking principles here. But what tends to happen is you put the thing up and actually it hurts the relationship. I've had a number of people who I've been able to marry say to me, if we had lived together before we were married, we never would have got married. Because actually it's so hard being together. It's so hard experiencing this togetherness. And now that we're married, well, we're going to stick with it because we're married now. And that's kind of the deal and we believe in it. But if we hadn't had that till death us do part, whatever is mine is yours, in sickness, in health, all of that stuff, we wouldn't have made it. I'll tell you what, Kate and I, we definitely wouldn't have made it. Next one, it says cohabiting increases the risk of divorce. Again, sometimes when you move in together, the decision engine is different for different partners. You know, for one, it's like fully up. You're saying, Philip, you're saying my decision engine isn't up when I'm moving in. It's fully powered. But the other person's might not be fully powered. They might be, yeah, I think, but can we just see and let's try it out? We were talking with a friend and they said, actually, I'm in this relationship and it's serious and we want to get married, we want to get engaged. But they just said, could we sleep together first so that we can make sure that we're sexually compatible? And again, this is one of those things where two people have a different view. It's what you call an unequal, asymmetric commitment in a relationship. One person is saying, I'll give you everything. I want to be with you. Another person is saying, yeah, but if I enjoy the sex, I'm in. Otherwise, I think I will move on. And because of this lack of clarity and sometimes a disparity in what the other person is thinking, unlike a wedding where you both share the same vows and it's very clear what it is, it actually sets you up from the very off with the chance of difficulty. And then finally, there's lower relational quality. Tends in marriage versus cohabiting, tends to be more arguments, less happiness. Now, again, I'm not knocking this, but I'm just saying, if we think about how commitment works, and if we think about choosing something, this makes sense. So back to the airplane, and then we'll just wrap up with a few key points. My point would be this. Let's go back. I want to invite you and encourage you to work on the decision engine, to really see how you can build your ability to commit in anything, but to be able to commit to a relationship. I want to give a huge shout out for any relationship that has been started and sustained, and especially married within the last 2 years. In fact, can we give a round of applause for our pandemic weddings? Because I've seen people put so much, they've overcome such difficulties, such hurdles, such challenges, and it has actually made the relationship stronger. It's challenge and it's difficulty and it's things not being easy and not being convenient that sets you up for the long haul. So always think decision engine. But within all of this, I just want you to know three things. First of all, there's zero judgment on this. Like I said, I've never met anyone who wanted to live with someone or even sleep with a person that they love who didn't do it out of a loving place. I'm just offering you stuff that the Bible puts forward. You're never going to hear this stuff from anywhere else, so it's worth taking into consideration. But there's zero judgment. There's zero condemnation. We do what we do out of good intentions and good motives. So I don't want anyone to hear this as a condemning or a critical thing. But secondly, what I would say is this. It's never too late to change the way that you are conducting a relationship. In fact, it can be a really positive thing. We do, as Chloe says in the video, we do these talks pretty much once every year. And I think about 3-4 years ago, there was a couple, fell in love, met through the church. We took them through their relationship, marriage prep training and all of that stuff, and that they were engaged to be married. And then we did one of these sessions, and then they spoke to us privately afterwards and said, actually, we've been sleeping together because we love one another, and we're going to get married in just a few weeks' time, but we've decided to stop sleeping together so that we can work on these other things without sex dominating and just taking up the whole conversation and all of our time. And in the weeks to come, they came back and said, actually, our relationship has got better. We changed it, even late on, but it demonstrably made us. We are better friends, we're better at communication, we feel closer to one another, and we have a kind of a sense that actually we can do this. We can be disciplined and boundaried in our sexuality, and that gives us a kind of confidence that we're not going to cheat on one another because we didn't cheat with one another. And so there's never, it's not a case where you think, well, you know, I've done this and I'm just going to stick with it. Actually, if you think this makes sense, it's never too late to change. Doesn't matter what your history is, it matters what your choices are today. And then finally this, before we pray. God loves you. God loves you. The very covenant of marriage is supposed to be the very tiniest shadow of how God feels about us. And if a covenant committed loving relationship says, all of me, for all of you, no matter what, then God says to us, all of me, for all of you, no matter what. There's nothing I can't forgive. There's nothing I can't heal. There's nothing I can't restore. There's nothing I can't make good. There's no slate I cannot wipe clean. There's no heart I cannot mend. It doesn't matter where you've been. It doesn't matter what you've done. It doesn't matter what has been done to you. I am all in, all of me that can be for all of you, no matter what. I can heal, I can restore, I can bless, and I'm here for you. And as we finish this series and we go into a time of prayer, worship, I just want you to hear that. I just want you to hear that God loves us unconditionally. And God invites us to join with him and love people in the way that he loves us, to be caught up with that, to actually involve him and engage him in the matters of our heart. God loves us no matter whether we are single, divorced, together, no matter whether your relationship is in a great place or whether it's challenging and you're working things through. God's love is big enough for you, and God's love is extended for you. So let's pray right now, and let's invite God to come and minister to us by his Spirit.